listen. Battle stations. To the sound of terror. To the cry of battle.
The peace treaty between the Federation and the Klingon Empire is in.
Witness a merciless enemy. One final hope.
Lieutenant Commander Worf.
No!
Reporting for duty, sir.
The showdown has just begun on the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, feeling like a man by shoving Morn around the corridors of Deep Space Nine.
Nice. And we have a very special guest this week, swinging a batleth and downing blood wine, Brett Orton.
Wow, Brett, it's so great to have you here. Thanks for joining us on the show today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I heard he was a long wait list to get me on here, so...
Yeah, you're well in demand. But for those who haven't figured it out, Brett is actually related to me.
What?
I know. It's interesting. We've had two other siblings, or no, you're the second sibling to come on the show. Cam, you have a sister, right?
I do. What? She's preparing for an episode for the undetermined future.
Yeah, well, I think we assigned it to her last September of 2016,
yes.
Right? Okay.
I think she's slowly starting. Okay. She's warming up.
She's halfway through the episode.
So, that's right.
Brett, I'll be honest. You were not the first pick.
You know. We say this to all of our guests. Yeah.
No. Here's the reason why. Cam, what is the conundrum this week?
We are going to talk about the DS9 double-length episode, The Way of the Warrior, from Season 4, the first episode of the season.
And the reason why I originally pitched this to our sister, Geneva, or Cam, what did you call her when she was initially on the show?
Genevieve.
Yeah. Or was it like Genevieve? Almost like a Voyager, like a reference to Genevieve Pujol?
No, that would have been clever.
Okay. So, no, but actually, we made my sister and your sister, Brett, watch Birthright Parts 1 and 2 from Star Trek The Next Generation, which was also a Worf-centric episode. Cam, it was a pretty slow-moving two-parter, was it not?
Yeah, but we got a lot of comedy out of it for the podcast.
Yes. Yeah. Jenna had some very incisive things to say about this very inappropriate relationship Worf was having with a very young Klingon woman.
Yes.
I wanted to follow up with Geneva about a Klingon-centric episode that I thought was a little bit more hard-hitting. Unfortunately, she could not make it today, but Brett, I'm actually genuinely glad that we could have you on the show. I had another episode in mind for you, but I think this is a very strong one as well. So thanks again for joining us here.
I am very happy to be here, very excited to be amongst you too. So
I'm curious, before we start, Brett, what was sort of your history with Star Trek?
My main history was growing up watching Tyler watch it.
Right.
And I
Yeah, Brett would sit next to the TV and just stare at me as I stared back at the TV. It was very awkward.
Tyler's faces were always very expressive, so I always enjoyed that.
Yeah.
So that was my history.
And yeah, it was a 7 of 9 would come on screen, and my eyes would just open so wide.
Every time we got to the Hollow Suite, I always saw him get pretty excited. So.
Wow. So, but do you remember me watching Star Trek when we were younger?
I do. Honestly, and it's Worf who always stuck out to me.
Was it?
The series.
Oh, okay.
I always saw him. I always knew
the
show.
I intended for you to be on this episode this entire time.
Ooh,
because it was a Worf-centric episode.
Just worked out.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But it's interesting because, I mean, Cam, we've discussed it before with Geneva. She did watch Star Trek with me when we were younger kids. I think she drifted away a little bit sooner. But it's just interesting that your main experience is just kind of watching me watch it, you know. And do you remember my Star Trek Voyager fan site that I built when I was younger?
I think you used to kick me out of your room when you were working on that, so I don't get to recall any of it.
It was those 7 of 9 photos. I mean, you know, I had to make sure that they uploaded, like, just correctly, bro.
You hung a sock on the doorknob?
Yeah. So, anyway.
A Voyager sock.
But most recently, Brett, like, have you kept up with, say, the new films that have come out or anything like that?
Yeah, I've watched all the films, first, second, and third. I think I've seen the second one twice.
Okay.
I'm probably the most familiar with that one.
Fan favorite, Star Trek Into Darkness.
Oh, mm-hmm. Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yeah.
No comma, so.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, that's true.
But, you know, here's, I think, a very good reason to have you on the show, mm-hmm. though. Not that there's not an abundance of those reasons.
We've got
the,
a list of bad reasons.
Yeah. Singular one.
But essentially, season 4 premiere, Way mm-hmm. of the Warrior, it was really supposed to reboot Deep Space Nine in a way to draw in a lot of maybe fans that have drifted away and other fans that were like, hey, you know, I'm intrigued by this. So they're introducing Michael Dorn. I remember seeing magazine covers, you know, saying that Michael Dorn is back on Star Trek. I didn't quite realize that he was actually going to become like a main cast member here of mm-hmm. Deep Space Nine until I actually walked into the comic book shop and I think it was like in Starlog magazine. Cam, did you ever read Starlog?
I did.
Yeah. So it's fascinating to see how maybe new audiences would approach Deep Space Nine because it had kind of that reputation, Cam, of being like kind of the slower, more contemplative series, and Voyager had just premiered the year before.
I'm really curious how many younger people of that era stuck with Deep Space Nine. It feels like so much more of an adult show.
Yeah, you know what? Honestly, for me, like I was a person who drifted away and went over to Star Trek Voyager. I definitely tuned in for this episode. I'm very excited to see Worf return to the franchise. So right. For like this young guy, I was probably, I'm guessing I would have been like 12, 13, mm-hmm. or what was this, 1995?
About that, yeah.
Yeah, so I would have been like 11, 12 when this premiered then.
Right.
So, Brett, would you have even been born at this point?
I would have been at least 1.5.
There you go. So what did you think?
Yeah, what are your memories of watching this episode?
I remember being very upset the entire time and a lot of crying.
So that's not Barney. Okay, so we'll gauge our kind of thoughts, going forward. But I want to start with you, Cam. Your the initial time. Let's go back to 1995.
Oh my God!
Do you have any recollection of people making a big deal of Worf going back to Star Trek?
I'm sure I knew about it. I'm sure that someone had mentioned it to me on the playground. I don't know what I was doing on a playground at that point, but
yeah, you're like 15.
14. Yeah, 14? 14 at that point. But I was...
Wait. Were you pretending you were Klingon and pushing around kids like they were Morn?
Yeah. No, I was trying to be like Worf, playing soccer against younger ones.
Oh, that's a good shout out to Let He Who's Without Sin for all you listeners that know.
I do remember, though, friends telling me that Worf was going to be on the show, but I also don't recall any of my friends actually watching Deep Space Nine.
Right.
So they may have been maybe kind of tuned onto the news, but I don't think any of them were into Deep Space Nine.
So it didn't necessarily draw people. Like, Worf was not the big draw that the studio bigwigs thought he would be.
They may have watched this episode.
Yeah.
But I don't recall any people suddenly being like, Deep Space Nine is so great, you know, week to week.
Okay. I remember watching it at the time. It made me want to stick with Deep Space Nine for the next little while because I do have vivid memories of tuning in the next week and watching The Visitor.
Right.
And just being like blown away. I was like, wow, you've got me, Deep Space Nine. And I think the next one was the one where O'Brien and Bashir crash land on that planet and Bashir figures out how to get the Jem'Hadar off Ketrasol White.
Right. Yeah.
Hippocratic Oath. I remember. So what I'm getting at, though, is like I think Way of the Warrior got me to stick around with Deep Space Nine. I wasn't floating in and out as much as I was. But by the time I think season 5 rolls around, I was pretty much a week-to-week viewer of Deep Space Nine.
Right.
Season 4, still a little bit every once in a while. But, why don't we gauge our thoughts? Look, we just watched it just mere moments ago. What are your initial reactions to this, Brett? Do you think that this episode kind of accomplishes maybe what it sets out to do with drawing in viewers that might be somewhat familiar with the franchise, or what are your thoughts? And honestly, you don't need a kiss butt, on this. Just the
most amazing experience of my life.
Yeah.
Well, like I said, I mean, this is my first time watching Deep Space Nine, an entire episode.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is me starting off the series. And I did absolutely enjoyed it. I really liked how much there just seemed like a lot more politics than I was anticipating.
Yeah.
Just like Klingons, Cardassians, the Dominion, all this kind of stuff. And I felt like...
Were you lost within all the mythology that was being expressed here?
I'm glad I was taking notes.
Okay.
Because, there was a lot, but I felt I could follow it. I felt I could infer a lot of what was going on from what was being said. And I didn't feel like the dialogue was really obvious or really choppy. Like, oh, this is what they're trying to get accomplished here. But, yeah, so it was good. I liked it as an intro.
Well, Ken, what did you think? Was it a Ron Moore script, this one?
Ira Stephen Bear and Robert Hewitt Wolf.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I Let me ask you this. How do you think they approach it with regards to maybe viewers like Brett, like maybe kind of the new people that were maybe not all that familiar with Deep Space Nine? Was there a lot of mythology to cover here?
I think there is a lot, but one of the smartest things they do is tell it through action mm-hmm. and through energy. Like, I was thinking right off the bat, we have this scene of Sisko and Kira, like, prowling the corridors with phaser rifles, which, by the way, I've never thought phaser rifles look cool or badass. But
I think the ones in Voyager look a little bit better, but not these DS9
nah,
ones.
They look lame. But anyway, it's them prowling the corridors. We see a changeling attacking. We're learning what a changeling is through action. We don't have, you know, Sisko turning to Kira and be like, well, changelings can do this, 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 and this. They come from the Dominion. And, you know, it's like a very seamless introduction to what a changeling can do through action, which is very smart.
I almost wanted to, like, lean over to Brett a couple times and, like, go, this is exposition, exposition, exposition. And, right. But you know what? I think this episode kind of, like you said, did it through action. And, like, there's other times where I was like, well, Brett, you know that Garrick, the tailor, like, here's all his backstory. Well, let me just ask you about that. Did you pick up on what this guy's backstory was, or what did you think of this Taylor character, who's one of the big fan favorites of the entire series?
I enjoyed his kind of dry wit.
No, and
that was the thing. I thought he just from the get-go, it seemed like he was a person who kind of fell from grace.
Sure.
He seemed to have a lot of tension with that other person, potentially a family member kind
Ducat.
Of tension. Ducat. But yeah, overall, I really liked his character. I thought he was very stinging with his remarks.
Well, I think the genius of this episode, Cam, is even though it's an action-heavy episode, so many great character beats throughout. Like, they don't forget about the characters. There's interactions between so many of them. And I think one of our complaints about some of these two-parters is how story-driven they can be. But does this not really feel kind of like an ensemble, as if you're kind of reintroducing a lot of these characters for the very first time, so you better give them something interesting to do?
Well, there is a lot of story to it,
yeah,
but a lot of it is told through character interactions. You know, a meeting between Odo and Worf. You know, it's like all these different characters, Ducat and Garrick. It's all these characters having a certain amount of tension or these sort of very kind of fiery talks or debates, and that's where the story is coming from. I think because of the fact the budget is really not there as much as I'm sure Star Trek would have liked. They have to depend more on really smart dialogue and characters talking.
I'll say this about the budget, though. With the action sequences, the phaser fights, the space battles, I remember at the time, like, watching this, I'd never seen like such an expensive looking episode.
This did seem like a bar raiser for Star Trek action.
I wonder if this kind of, like, I don't know, hampered the budget throughout the rest of the year to a certain degree.
I've got a trivia note on this whole battle.
Do
which
share.
Is they saved money by all the ships in the background using Playmates toys.
I can appreciate that.
And also the Hallmark ornaments.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Now I can pretend that those toys that I have in my bedroom were actually a part of Star Trek history to a certain degree.
Sure.
Sure. Okay. Well, guys, let's dive into it, though. I mean, Brett, I'm going to keep coming back to you because I'm fascinated what, like, a new viewer has to think about a lot of this stuff. But, Cam, there's so many great beats throughout this. I mentioned just even at the top, I mean, Kira saying to Sisko, hey, do you want to go grab dinner? Would this have happened 2 years ago, for example?
It would have been more of a quarrelsome discussion about dinner.
You know, like arguing about Bajoran farmers or something like that.
Gratitude festival.
Yes. Yeah. You know, so it's interesting to see where the characters are compared to just, you know, 3 seasons ago when the series started. And I'm digging a lot of the, just making Sisko more human at this point with his, you know, nascent relationship with Cassidy Yates. Who
leisurely wardrobe.
You love the vest.
I did, not? Yes.
Yeah, Sisko's wearing one badass vest in this one. Just for those who don't recall, though, I mean, Way of the Warrior, essentially the Klingons are back in action here. They arrive on the station. They're searching through ships, Cassidy's freighter, for example. And they have to call in Worf. Starfleet calls in Worf to figure out what's going on. He realizes there's...
Because he's the guy you'd want to call in to deal with a delicate situation.
Well, you know, in our last two-parter Cam, in which we looked at... I always get these two-parters
Improbable Cause and The Die Is Cast.
And The Die Is Cast, yes. Yeah. But there was really Odo being kind of the investigator here. And we talked a lot about how Worf really never did that on Next Generation.
Yeah.
But in this situation, we do see Investigator Worf, which I do appreciate. But, of course, it took him to get to Deep Space Nine until he got to do anything interesting like that.
Right.
So Worf finds out that essentially there's been an uprising on Cardassia, and the Klingons figure the founders are the ones behind it here. Brett, we may end up spoiling some stuff for you. If you ever want to go into all 170 some episodes of Deep Space Nine, there may be some spoilers thrown about here. But I think this, Cam, is this a very important episode with regards to the Deep Space Nine mythology here?
I would say yes.
I would say so. Incredibly very much so. Yeah. Like, and I had forgotten just how important.
Yeah, like my memories of it going into it were just that I remembered it was the introduction of Worf, which of course is important, but rewatching it, I was like, my God, a lot of stuff comes from this two-parter.
Yeah.
Or extended length episode.
Well, and it's interesting because, yeah, it did. I did watch it at the extended length version when it first premiered, so it's, yeah. I think that was a fun way to watch it. And it works here as, because a lot of the times we'll be watching the two-parters, Brett, and it'll say, to be continued, and it's a very obvious to be continued beat, which, you know, whatever. But let's start with this, because I think it's fascinating that they're addressing Worf's arc here with the sense of community and family that he developed on Enterprise.
Yeah.
And that's all fallen apart since the destruction of the Enterprise D in Star Trek Generations.
Yeah, what a glorious end it had, too.
It was left abandoned on an abandoned planet.
Yeah.
So there you go. Yeah. Well, and so Worf really doesn't know what to do with himself. He's hanging out at this Klingon monastery. He's letting Alexander hang out with his grandparents.
So long, Alexander.
Yeah, Worf doesn't want to be a father, obviously. You know, so Worf is lost, and he's very much in like a similar situation as Sisko was when we first met Sisko in Emissary, where Sisko's a single father trying to raise his boy. He doesn't know if, you know, Starfleet's really in his future. He doesn't think, you know, Starfleet is the future for him here.
Right.
And Worf has a similar dilemma that he's dealing with. Well, what did you think of some of the counseling that Sisko gave to Worf more towards the end of this, Cam?
Well, I really enjoy how DS9 parallels the characters, which is something I don't even know that I noticed as much on the first watch.
Yeah.
We talked with the Dias cast in Probable Cause two-parter how they paralleled, was it Odo and Garak? And I did appreciate that again here, where we have Sisko and Worf going on a similar journey, and Sisko able to kind of play a bit of a mentor role in Worf's decision-making. And then we even had a moment in this episode where Odo kind of steps in, like, trying to take that role a bit.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, I too have been torn between my people and Starfleet. Or
I love that. Because and it's picking up on that whole, you know, conflict that he was having in the previous two-parter, Improbable Cause, the Dias cast as well.
Yeah.
I'm very glad that Garak and Odo were able to make up, and Odo could show him his new tricks when it comes to eating in the Replimat.
But it left me wondering, like, do you recall TNG ever doing this with their two-parters? Like, really paralleling two character journeys?
Well, do you get the sense, though, I think I kind of alluded to it, but I think the TNG two-parters were generally more story-focused and usually focused on, like, one or two characters max.
Right, yeah.
This seems as if they had so much breathing room, so many more little B-stories to share to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What about you? I mean, are you following Worf's journey? Like, do you understand what this guy's going through? Because I don't think you ever saw the Star Trek film where the Enterprise D Picard ship was destroyed. Did you?
I have a very vivid memory of the VCR cover of that,
okay.
But that's the extent of my knowledge.
Sure. Okay. But what did you make of, like, were you invested in this journey that this character that you may not know so well, but that you do recognize Worf?
Oh, absolutely. And I was very fascinated that Worf had just been hanging out on a Klingon monastery. I was really curious, like, how popular those are amongst the Klingon people. Maybe in the past 20 years, I guess, of peace, if those have sprung up, but I was investing with what Worf was going to. I was curious why he wasn't more invested in hanging out with his son, but I take it he's not the best father, so
no.
But he brought a picture, so it was really, really nice.
I do remember watching it 22 years ago and thinking, like, yeah, being very excited to know what Worf was up to since.
I thought you were going to say very excited to know what Alexander had been up to.
But discovering that Worf had just been hanging out at a monastery ever since the Enterprise had been destroyed, I was just like, huh. That's a bit of a letdown.
It's a little depressing.
Yeah.
I love that DS9 is willing to take this character in far darker and more unpleasant route than I think TNG would have ever had the guts to do.
Yeah. No doubt about that. Cam, we may lose Brett for just a second, but we can circle around to him. But I think we have the introduction of one of the most significant recurring characters here with Martok. Or Dewey.
Not really.
So, Brett, again, it's a bit of a spoiler, but
that's okay.
Cam, watching this, is this your second time that you've seen Way of the Warrior?
Yeah.
Okay. So, when you watched it just now, did you watch it the whole time looking at Martok saying, oh, he's actually the changeling, or was it not something that really occurred to you?
Right from the moment he showed up. I kept thinking that Martok seems a little off model compared to the Martok I know and love from later in the series. And then I just had to constantly remind myself, it's not Martok.
Yeah. And maybe it kind of explains, you know, why his kid Drex is such an ill-behaved child.
Who do you think's worse, Drex or Alexander? Would you rather be the father of?
Oh, well, I think Drex is just dishonorable.
Okay.
You know, like picking on Morn, like the whole episode. Brett, I noticed he kept laughing at that frequent bar patron who seemed to show up everywhere.
I thought he was so funny. I wanted to know if he was a regular character or not, but he seemed like he was afraid of the Klingons, and then he just kept popping up, and I was like, oh, it's that guy.
I think he's appeared like in more episodes than any other extra, like, ever, essentially in Star Trek. He's just always hanging at the bar. He's never had a single line in the entire series, but he has had an entire episode dedicated to him, which is fascinating to think.
Just goes from his POV?
No, he disappears in Who Mourns for Mourn, and people are fighting over their inheritance because they figure he's dead.
There was a moment early in this where they mentioned that Morn is going to meet with, like, Ensign Sanders.
Yes.
And I'm like, what would he possibly be meeting with Ensign Sanders about?
I think maybe Odo was just trying to shoo him away, make sure that Klingons don't rough him up anymore. But, yeah, so going back to Martok, though, it's interesting because, you know, however different he appears here, you can always rationalize it in your brain and figure out that's he's actually just the changeling form of Martok. This is not the Martok that we know and love. He does not pop up the like Martok Prime. What is the name of that other two-parter? In Purgatory's Shadow, I think. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Yeah. And so then we get Eyeless Martok, which is pretty badass, though.
Oh, yeah. He's the best.
Do you remember? I don't know. Okay, so I think you had been to Star Trek conventions, and you've seen J.G. Hertzler up on stage before you ever saw Martok on screen.
Correct.
What did you make of Martok as a character when you were watching it the first time? Did you figure, oh, this is supposed to be a significant guy, or what was your thought process?
I don't think he made a huge impact on me the first time I watched this two-parter. I think he was more of a character who, I don't think I really got invested in him, honestly, until the real Martok showed up. And then he became more like, oh, okay, this character's... He wasn't like an instant, like, this guy's a badass. It kind of took some time for me to come around on him.
You also had the benefit of knowing that he was going to be a significant character. I remember watching this back in the day.
Yeah.
Martok wasn't revealed, or he did not appear again until Apocalypse Rising. That was the season 5 premiere. So it had been exactly 1 year since he had been on Star Trek.
Right.
I honestly didn't remember him from being in Way of the Warrior when I saw the season 5 premiere and he was revealed to be the changeling. To me, I just thought he was just some random Klingon, really. And so it took a while until we got around to In Purgatory's Shadow that I started thinking, oh, this guy, I know who this is now.
Right. No, yeah, like Martok was a fairly smooth transition for me watching it originally, of just like, you know, kind of being indifferent and then growing to love him. I think Gowron was the bigger shock, watching him on Deep Space Nine and really thinking he was the worst, like just a total villain. And then going to TNG and being expected to like him.
Yeah, sure.
Because I watched them out of order.
Yeah, so we asked you about this Martok guy.
I thought Martok was the was the guy who's in the bar patron. I was confused for a second.
Oh, okay.
So he's the Klingon guy. Yeah,
he's the Klingon guy with the kind of the scars.
To what was going on there?
Yeah,
that's cool. Right.
So this entire time you thought that the bar patron was revealed as the big changeling infiltrator.
What a surprise! I never would have guessed that.
Nobody would suspect. and then Gowron was like the chancellor, the guy with the big bulging eyes, and
offered Worf to come along.
Yeah.
And then Worf said no.
Yeah. I don't know. Any thoughts about this Gowron character? He had a lot of backstory with Worf, but on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Well, he seemed like a really big character, and honestly, like, I liked him, and I think, like, initially, I wouldn't normally just like most of the Klingons I see, but then he seemed like
racist.
A likable, absolutely, specious. Yeah. But no, he seemed like a cool character, and then I was like, oh, I guess he's kind of bad, but then he fought, or he left the battle to save the Empire, so I was like, oh, he's reasonable for a Klingon.
You know, Cam, one of these days, we need to examine Gowron's arc throughout Star Trek.
That would be fun.
Because it's all over the place, is it not?
It is,
yes. And to see, I don't want to spoil anything.
And it ends spectacularly.
Well, his conclusion in the franchise is something that we would no doubt debate for quite some time as well. But I don't know, did he seem to have more of a Ren and Stimpy kind of voice in his DS9 debut here?
Well, the whole time I'm watching it, I'm asking myself, is Robert O'Reilly a good actor, or is he just a big actor?
I just wonder if he's almost doing, like, an impersonation of his previous performance.
He's
going
big. Like, there's no subtlety whatsoever in that performance.
But you know what? We played his the VCR game in featuring Robert O'Reilly, Colonel what? Or he had a name. He wasn't playing Gowron.
It started with a K, didn't it? It was like Cavlon or Cavlon.
Kavok?
Kavok.
Captain Kavok.
Yes.
Yes. What's his beige?
Yes.
Yes. For all those, Kim, what was the name of that game?
Klingon Encounter or something? Klingon Attack?
Yeah, it was great. Robert O'Reilly, a very memorable guy here. Mm-hmm. Brett, you'd no doubt have fun going to the conventions and watching him up on stage with the Martok actor, J.G. Hertzler. Cam, they rap?
Yeah.
And they dress in kimonos?
From what I can tell, their panel mostly consists of them in full Klingon makeup and attire screaming into a microphone for an hour.
Yeah. I think we both like the characters.
Yes, very much.
I think we skipped the panel last year.
I can only handle so much.
Yeah. We've seen it before.
Yes.
So, yeah. But I jump ahead. Oh, okay. Worf's introduced to so many characters here. Maybe we can jump on them one by one. I'm going to go to my favorite, though. When he first meets Kira, he looks at her in her medieval attire after she gets out of the holosuite. He has the best line. This is my favorite Michael Dorn line delivery the entire episode, but nice hat. Like, that's all I need to say here. But, Cam, what do you make of this? Because I think this is the much more significant introduction, but him and Dax meeting for the first time. Do they have chemistry right away, in your opinion?
I was actually shocked how early they kind of set the pebbles for the love trail.
I know. You know, it wasn't just that encounter within the holosuite when they're sparring, but it's right when... Hey, Jadzia's dressed up in medieval attire as well, and she's just like, I don't usually dress this way either.
I know. It was right off the bat, and she says the Klingon phrase to him that, you know, isn't translated for the audience.
But do you know the translation, Cam?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay.
I'd like to learn it, though.
well, it doesn't translate well.
But you see from his expression, like, whatever she said, it meant something.
Yeah. And even just, like, cool little things like... playing darts with Bashir and O'Brien.
I do not play games.
But the one thing I really like, though, is Brett, I don't know if you realize this, but O'Brien, the curly-haired Irishman that's talking to Worf a lot, they served on the Enterprise together. O'Brien was a character from Next Generation. Mm-hmm. You get the camaraderie that they have to a certain degree?
I definitely thought that it was like they had a relationship. Like, it was clear they weren't meeting each other for the first time. So,
yeah.
It was noticeable.
Cam, do we get any sense of this after Way of the Warrior?
I really can't answer that.
Yeah.
It's tough for me to recall.
Exactly.
Is there much?
I think they made fun of Reg Barkley in one episode.
Right.
And I don't really remember much beyond that. They really had it going early on that it's the Bashir and O'Brien relationship, that these are the buds. And to me, it was kind of disappointing that O'Brien and Worf didn't really reminisce. Worf, gave birth, or didn't give birth, but he
No, what is this? Is this a fan fiction story you wrote?
No. But he delivered Molly O'Brien.
Right, of course.
Yeah. So, he has that special relationship with O'Brien.
Not only that, they were both in those poker games.
Wait, was O'Brien in the poker games?
Sometimes, yes. He was.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. You'd think that they'd make more of an effort, but...
I don't know the story there. Maybe because they were developing the O'Brien and Bashir friendship.
Yeah.
they were like, we don't want Worf coming in the way of this. Well, I don't know.
Think about this. You got the O'Brien and Bashir friendship developing. You've got the Dax and Worf relationship developing. And I think those respective actors all had so much chemistry. You know, just go with something that makes a lot of sense there.
Right. No, I agree.
Okay. Well, I am wondering, though, with regards to the future of Worf on Deep Space Nine here. Do you see this character, Brett, making an easy transition into kind of the whole deal with Deep Space Nine, though, is unlike Next Generation, which is a crew made up of kind of superhuman, perfect people, you know, this is more of a station of misfits, like the flawed human beings. Mm-hmm. Do you see that Worf could fit in easily, even though he was complaining about having to leave his Enterprise family, though? Do you see that there's a place for him on Deep Space Nine?
You know, I mean, it's hard for me to have my footing in this series. I haven't seen The Next Generation either, so I just imagine, I think he will blend in with everybody. I think he'll kind of find his space. I mean, everyone seems nice on this ship, so I don't know why they wouldn't be nice to him.
Nice?
Nice. that Kira, the N in Kira N stands for nice.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, all right. I don't know, Cam, what do you think about Worf's place within this ensemble cast here?
Well, like, you kind of underlined it perfectly where you said it's a place of misfits. And Worf may be the biggest misfit in all of Star Trek. I mean, talk about a guy who's conflicted in every single category you could possibly put him in.
He's... Cam, when we did the court-martial episode and we just talked about all the Worf's misdeeds.
Yes.
Like, this guy, the fact that he's not in jail right now is fascinating, but he still is a fan favorite, and he's a character that you feel is honorable anyways. So, for such a flawed character, I'm intrigued by how his existence within the Star Trek universe still makes sense to me.
Is he the biggest misfit on Deep Space Nine? Who stands out to you as being a bigger one?
Okay, well, here, like, Quark... I think Quark fits in quite well.
Yes.
You know, like, he's kind of the bad boy of Deep Space Nine, as we determined in our episode, Bad Boys of Star Trek. I mean, obviously, Sisko's the commander. He's got to have, you know, that authority. You know, everybody respects Nerys.
Mm-hmm.
We find out later that Bashir started off as kind of annoying.
Right.
And then we find out later that he's, like, genetically enhanced. So that's kind of a misfit.
Everyone loves Kira.
Yeah. O'Brien's the everyman. Yeah. Maybe the closest other misfit would be Odo.
Yeah.
Is that it?
I
mean, Dax.
Well, there's Garak.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, who's more popular on the station, Garak or Worf, though? I think Garak might be.
I think Garak has closer friendships, for sure.
Not among too many Bajorans, but... Yeah.
No, but but you look at Worf, who spends at least the first handful of episodes, like, cooped up on the Defiant.
Yeah.
Refusing to come out. It's a little strange.
Something to look forward to.
Brett, question...
Spoiler.
Yeah, I know. question for you. Did you ever play make-believe when you were a kid?
Quite very often.
And what did you make-believe about?
That I was on the Enterprise with Worf.
Okay. I thought it was going to be similar to Kira, where she would fantasize about Cardassians not killing Bajorans. Was that a bit of an awkward exchange between her and Dax, Cam?
On the Hubishian bath program?
Yeah, do you guys want to talk about the Trill spa? Because this is immediately after... Okay, we have an action-packed teaser sequence where you're running down the corridors, shooting phaser rifles.
Well, they weren't actually shooting.
Yeah.
They were holding them.
O'Brien said, "Bang, you're dead."
Yeah.
That he literally
Let's
said
not
that.
Build it up too much.
Okay. Well, no, there was that moment where they did do the phaser spray to figure out that what was Odo hiding as? Like a blanket on a chair?
It looked like it, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. Anyway, so we've got this action packed teaser, and then we come back, and it's very clear Jadzia is enjoying herself at a Trill spa in the holosuite. Very hunky-looking men draped all over her. And
did she, like, race from the training to that?
She must have.
Yeah, like once that was wrapped up, she was in the spa.
I bet the training actually interrupted the spa day, and so she's like, I got to go right back. But I mean, it's an interesting way. This is meant to draw in new people, so you start with an action sequence.
It worked.
I had no idea what the Holo Suite was at first. I thought this was a place on the ship, and these were like crew members. I was like, okay.
It's just she just grabs them, and they all just chill. Let's say, you know.
Where's human resources?
It would be a little bit inappropriate. Hey, Cam, is this the way you grab audiences if you're trying to reboot the series?
I mean, I guess sex sells, although I don't know if it does on Star Trek.
We did do the Valentine's episode 3 years ago called When Star Trek Gets Sexy.
That's true. That's true. I mean, they tried it with the Seven of Nine, of course. So was this how Star Trek was trying to make DS9 sexy?
Yeah. What was the game plan here? Like more Trill baths?
It makes sense to me because Dax Jadzia is a very liberated character.
Yeah.
So I could see her using this program. It makes sense to me. And also that Kira would be uncomfortable in it. Like, I think they maybe took a moment that could be rife with unintentional comedy and made it about character. So I think it actually works.
Okay, but what is Jadzia a good friend to Kira? Because she keeps taking her on these holosuite adventures that Kira clearly does not want to be on. What would you do if you had a friend who kept taking you to, I don't know, King Arthur adventures or Trill spa adventures that you really did not care for?
I think they should really, I mean, she doesn't have much of an imagination, so she can't really think of any place to go herself.
That's very insightful.
But yeah, I felt upset that Lancelot apparently doesn't care about consent, so no? That's unfortunate.
Especially with a married woman.
Yeah. I did enjoy that her imagination was to pretend she was married in a medieval fantasy thing of old places.
Yeah, what are these two space aliens doing in like King Arthur's court?
I did not even think about that.
It's very, this is the one thing that, well, not the one thing, but one of the many things that kind of bugs me about Star Trek is it's very Earth-centric.
Yes.
You know, and it's just kind of like, okay, sure. Jadzia loves King Arthur.
I mean, Jadzia, I guess you get a bit of a free reign because she's such a worldly character and has spent a lot of time with humans and may have, you know, stumbled upon that that story.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I have a hard time picturing like a 26-year-old like Jadzia being like, you know what? I'm gonna take Kira to like the Knights of the Round Table.
We'll wear these hats. It'll be amazing.
Yeah, and I like to think it was Richard Gere as Lancelot.
Was that first night?
Yeah,
yeah.
From I think the year that this episode aired.
Oh wow!
I think it might have been
a little bit of cross promotion.
Yeah. It didn't work for first night.
Cam, did you ever go to that, I forget what it's called, but like the, you can go to Los Angeles and they have like this kind of medieval night.
Medieval Times?
Medieval Times, yeah.
I did it when I was, I guess, like 7 or 8 years old. Brett, we loved it.
Do you remember going there?
I do.
During
a massive
childhood?
Drumstick.
I was did
worried,
you finish
though.
It?
Probably not.
No, okay.
I was too worried to see if the Black Knight was going to win or not.
I thought we had the White Knight.
Yeah, I was worried the Black Knight was going to win.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, okay, we're all assigned, of course, as you would know,
yes.
a knight to cheer for. We had the White Knight the Orton dinner table. Oh, do you recall who you had?
Oh, I think we had, was there one that was like a checkered knight? I don't think it was a single color.
Okay, yeah, that would make sense.
Then. Yeah.
What I'm getting into here, is this actually...
Medieval Times is great. Take the whole family.
I wish I had a
this
holodeck.
Episode is sponsored by Medieval Times.
Is this where Jadzia brought Kira, and this is why Kira wasn't having fun?
It is very strange, because if you've got a friend who's Bajoran, so Bajoran culture, and you want to introduce her to holosuites, would this be the go-to?
Medieval Times.
Which is... right from the get-go, very like archaic and sexist. Is this really the best place for kind of a very like woman of her time?
No.
Kira?
Where would you take Kira?
Oh, you know, I don't think the massage thing was that bad an idea, frankly.
No.
But
no, I think Odo figured it out. I know. 1960s Las Vegas lounge.
She seemed to like that more.
She did, yeah. She genuinely seemed to like Vic Fontaine's.
Yeah. I think Vic Fontaine's is the right idea. Like something that's more like maybe musical or like a festival type thing. Not like let's go role play ancient English stories.
Yeah. Brett, I know you've only just been introduced to Kira. She's a bit of a mercurial character, but she's also very spiritual. She was a child soldier, as you know, you probably figured out maybe from some of her make-believe stories that she told us about on this episode.
Well, she also got shanked at the last the end of the episode. Yeah. She was okay. So I was impressed. Oh. I did not anticipate she'd be the character to take a knife into like the kidneys and be like, yeah, okay.
Well, Cam, you and I am in our Who's the Ultimate Star Trek Fighter episode. You know, Kira made it pretty far. She did not ultimately make it to the end. But, I mean, we would rank her as among the toughest characters, if not the, like, toughest.
Despite the fact she was the only one injured in this episode.
Hey, but, you know, I bet the Klingons are like, oh, man, this is, like, priority number one. Right. You know, like, she keeps knocking all of us out.
Take out the ace in the hole, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, where would you take Kira on a holosuite adventure then, Brett?
Yeah.
The hospital?
Yeah,
the hospital. To get that kidney fixed?
That would have been my first go-to.
The hospital from Star Trek 4.
Yeah, after the Christmas music playing in the halls.
Yeah.
Well, if she's a Mongolian, or sorry, if she's a...
What?
This was going somewhere. I was going to say, oh, she's a warrior and she's into human history. She can take her back to the Mongolian era and see how she handles herself. Con.
Is she into human history? I never got that from
her.
She
seems largely ignorant to it. I mean, why are there no Bajoran programs?
I'm sure there are, but...
Wait, Kira had more fun, I think, in Move Along Home playing hopscotch than she did in this episode in Holosuite.
Maybe I would say they're about even, though. I remember her not enjoying hopscotch.
Well,
she said, you guys are explorers, I'm an administrator.
That's true, yeah.
You know, she wasn't really enjoying it the way, say, Jadzia was at that time.
Sure.
Okay, maybe beyond this...
No, we need to talk about this more
medieval times discussion, you know, at this part. One thing I do want to outline is the Garak and Dukat back and forth, especially because this actually becomes a bit of a... Not so much a plot point, but it is brought up again in later seasons where Garak says, I just wish, like, I had the chance to kill Dukat at the time, and I regret not doing that, you know, because it all comes back to haunt him in a very horrible kind of way, especially.
Right.
So
haunts everyone.
Yes, and so it's fascinating to see that, you know, they're, looks like they're in the same quarter that, like, Zial was murdered in, you know?
Yeah,
but I do like the back and forth between the two of them.
They call it Blood Alley.
Oh God. the back and forth between the two of them. Do you recall that many scenes between Garak and Dukat throughout the course of the series?
I don't know.
Yeah.
And so I really appreciated that this episode gave them quite a bit of time to spar off one another.
And it's great that they do have that backstory that you can tell that exists, that animosity that goes back like years, you know? So I dig it. And I don't know. Do you think Dukat was being kind of mean about the whole hemming women's dresses comment that he made to Garak?
I mean, yes. But do you really think it bothered Garak?
No, not at all. But here's what I think might have bothered Garak is if he was in ops when Bashir made his own like catty comment about Garak having to go back and hem pants for a living.
That seemed a little out of character for Bashir.
It seemed kind of mean. And
he seemed to be one of the few that's actually sympathetic to Garak.
Yeah, like Brett, Bashir and Garak, they hang out all the time. They have lunches together. Like he seems. Do you think that he's, you know, essentially his closest friend aboard the station?
Yeah.
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 So
easy.
You made like a really kind
of. What character do you think that would have made more sense coming out of? Maybe O'Brien?
Yeah. Immediately, as soon as you're asking that question, I immediately thought O'Brien.
Yeah.
Perhaps,
I could see also Kira.
Yeah. But she was too busy bleeding out at that point.
That's
so, yeah.
Lying it's just, on the floor.
Yeah. She's like, good one, doctor. Oh. But we didn't talk too much about Quark. Mm. How do you think? What do you make of a character like Quark? Like, I'm sure you recognized him from Star Trek.
He was the other person who stuck out in my mind. It's all the aliens, I think, that are the most obvious as a child. And yeah, I mean, I always, as a child, I always got this weird kind of sinister kind of vibe from him. And then seeing him once again as an adult, seeing his character, he's not a sinister character, but he's, I guess, a bit hard. Like, you know, he's seen some things. But I thought he was fascinating. I really liked how he. He started talking about Starfleet kind of being insidious in its own way.
Yeah, we need to talk about that.
Let's
scene.
Talk about this because he, because essentially they're having some Kanar. There's 80 crates of the well-known Cardassian adult beverage.
That'll
come
in handy later.
It will. Not such a bad investment, Quark. Yeah. You know, but essentially Garak and Quark are talking about this over some Kanar, and Quark's like, "Hey, try this. It's called root beer." And Garak's like, "It's vile." But, you know, it's sweet and it grows on you. And as you said, Brett, and as Garrick describes it, it's insidious, much like the Federation, you know. Do you consider, Cam, this vile drink, root beer, to be like a good metaphor for the Federation? Or do you think it's more of these characters' interpretation, these outsider characters who've been kind of entrenched in this Federation way of life for the last 3 years? Do you think it's more their interpretation of it, or do you think this is what the writers are actually kind of trying to say about the Federation?
I think it belongs, this sort of point of view belongs more to the outsiders. Yeah. Because for both Garrick and Quark, they are people that do not really belong to sort of positive forces for change in any way, shape, or form. Anything that's really progressive. I mean,
no.
With Garrick being with the Obsidian Order, which is, Brett, sort of like the covert ops of on Cardassia. Oh, like, okay. You know, dirty dealings, that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. We didn't ever explain to you his backstory, but essentially he's an exiled ex-spy.
Oh, right. So now he's a tailor.
Okay. Yeah. Now he's a tailor.
He's done some things.
Oh, he's done things. Yeah.
The Obsidian Order.
He's sewn some
pants. The Obsidian Order, not the most positive of groups. And then Quark obviously is, you know, run a business and is a just wants to make profits. So I think this makes a lot of sense for these two because this is the first time maybe they actually feel a little bit of loyalty to an actual organization that could do good.
Well, think about it this way. What are their options? Would they rather have the Klingons overrun the station?
Maybe this scene doesn't happen if those Klingons don't show up. That may have been kind of the rude awakening that, oh, crap.
Yeah, but it's such a great scene, and I think it's a good way of summing up how, like you say, the outsiders would feel about the Federation that they initially find it like really grating to be around, but then after a while you're like, oh, you know what? Maybe it's not so bad when you consider the other options that are out there in the Alpha Quadrant right now.
And it could represent people to come to other countries. And, you know, the country does become their home. It doesn't mean they like everything about it, but they might recognize that, hey, this is maybe the best that I could, you know, hope for.
Yeah.
So what I like about this scene is that I think it's maybe the most memorable scene in this entire two-parter. It's up there.
The most memorable. Oh, okay.
It's up there.
I'll definitely vouch for that as being one of the most memorable.
Yeah.
Because, you know what? It surprises me. There's so many things. Okay. Going into this, you mentioned it. There's so many things I had forgotten. But as I came around watching it, I was like, beat after beat, I was just like, oh, this is so iconic. I remember this. Oh, this happened in this episode. For instance, I mean, this is the debut of Sisko with a shaved head.
Right, yeah.
I mean, that is iconic, if not anything else here.
What kind of hair did he have before?
Yeah, it was sort of close crop.
Oh, I thought the Picard thing he had going for him was working.
Yeah.
Oh, it worked.
Oh, yeah, but you know, I think this kind of scene is a bit of a turning point for the character where he goes from kind of the dad look, you know, to kind of the badass military man.
Captain look.
Yeah, you know, because I think he was only promoted to captain in the previous episode, was he not?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, his debut is, I guess his second episode as captain is pretty badass here.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to Quark, Cam, you seized on something that's very good. He's not like a force for progressive good necessarily aboard the station.
I mean, even in this episode, he's talking about his cousin Gayla who sells weapons.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to bring up here. You know, and Brett, this is going to be actual. We get to meet cousin Gayla in future episodes, and
you go to his moon.
Yeah, you know, Quark actually pursues this way of life of getting into the weapons business, and I think that episode is such an important one with regards to was that business as usual?
Sure.
Sure. Okay.
I'm willing to travel down that road with you if that's your choice.
Okay. I think that might be the episode there. But to me, I think that's such an important episode for Quark's character when he kind of comes to realize maybe, even if this doesn't make me fully Ferengi, maybe profit isn't everything. Maybe there's a line that can be drawn.
And I'm so glad that this scene made it into this episode because it almost got cut multiple times.
Oh, really?
It was something that they almost cut out of the script and they shot it and they wanted to cut it. The studio wanted to cut it. Ron Moore was a huge proponent of the scene. He was like, we have to keep this.
Yeah.
So they managed to get it onto the air for the, you know, when they aired the double length episode. And then when they were selling it to syndication, they wanted to cut it again. So, like, this scene almost got cut multiple times.
That irks me because I agree, Cam, that this is such an iconic, this is such a kind of a cornerstone scene of this episode. And I think it's something that you ask the average fan of Deep Space Nine, and few people are going to forget about this root beer scene, essentially.
I mean, I had seen this two-parter before, or feature-length episode, and there's a lot of great moments, but I'd forgotten a lot, whereas I've never forgotten that root beer scene.
Yeah. As we wind up just a little bit here, maybe just a couple beats we can rail off. But, for your own knowledge, Brett, mm-hmm. I mean, they keep talking about, the Cardassians, the Klingons, and they keep talking about the Dominion, right? Mm-hmm. Essentially, the founders who rule the Dominion, they're the same species as Odo, the chief of security. They're
shiftlings, changelings.
Mm-hmm. Or shapeshifters, some people, it's a bit of a slur to call them shapeshifters, ooh, though. But essentially,
How dare you?
They're big on their identity, clearly.
But what do you make of this idea that, do you like to think that they are successful, though, with this plan? Because Martok is really pushing for a lot of aggression.
Right.
They are successfully engaged with the Klingons, and the Cardassians are fighting each other. The Federation are even finding themselves in the middle of this. What do you think about this with regards Way of the Warrior with regards to the Dominion War mythology that builds up throughout the series?
What I like about it a lot is that it sets up the Dominion as not just a physical threat, because we've seen the Jem'Hadar attacking and crashing, which a lot of space operas or science fiction, movies or shows would make the obvious leap of just have them be like a big physical threat.
Yes.
Like, it's very tough to beat the Dominion because they've got a lot of great warships. But what I like about this episode is that it establishes them as a strategic threat. Mm. Like, they may be smarter than the Federation or the Cardassians sometimes.
Well, it's causing political chaos.
Yeah.
And who knows? Like, to me, just the fact that nobody on the Dotapa Council happened to be a changeling, that doesn't mean that, the military government was somehow overthrown without any influence from the changelings. I don't think they ever addressed that throughout the series, but to me, I think it's kind of an intriguing theory that this came from the changelings as well. And they're also infiltrating the Klingons as well. And to a certain degree, we kind of see that happened somewhat, maybe in the next DS9 two-parter with regards to the Federation. We'll have to jog my memory.
Which is the Homefront.
Homefront and Paradise Lost.
Which was originally supposed to be the premiere. It was actually supposed to be a cliffhanger connecting seasons 3 and 4, and then that got completely scrapped because the studio refused to have a two-parter connecting the two seasons.
Okay, then.
So that led to a complete rejiggering and led to this being the premiere.
Well, I'm glad that they liked having basics as a cliffhanger on Star Trek Voyager then. So, there you go. I'm sorry. I don't think Homefront Paradise Lost would have been nearly as strong a 1-2 punch as, say, Way of the Warrior as this feature-length episode.
No, I agree.
Here. Yeah. All right. But, Brett, what do you make of kind of political instability versus, Force as kind of the big reckoning tool?
I think that's just, it makes such a more compelling villain. I think that's just so much more. It's much more scary. Like, it comes back to that unbreakable line. It's not the big scary villain who's the real problem. It's the mental villain. And I thought the way that they go about it, like you say, pitting everyone against each other and that they're shapeshifters, I think that's like their natural way of going about things with that kind of subvert, covert kind of thing going on.
You made me think of something, because the three of us, we went and saw Fate of the Furious just a few days ago.
Yes.
And you and I came
equally
out of there.
Equally intelligent.
But that 40-minute long kind of climax action sequence, at a certain point, I kind of checked out where it's just like, action sequence, action sequence, action sequence.
One submarine still following them.
Yeah.
I know. But
how long did that submarine follow them? It must have been like 10 minutes, right?
At least, yeah. You know, but the stuff that I'm far more invested in film and TV is when there's interpersonal conflict. Mm. And I like that the mental factor versus, the physical factor when we're talking about a villain here, like who can get into your mind in a way.
And are you implying Charlize Theron didn't do that to Dominic Toretto?
Well, she did plant a kiss on him in front of his girlfriend. That's or right. His wife, actually.
Yeah.
So there, that was psychological warfare.
Yeah. Never explained, because she was even like, you didn't have to. And he's like, oh, I didn't.
Yeah.
And everyone just kind of shrugs, goes about their day.
Yeah. Never mentioned again.
I'm not ever going to suggest using that excuse on your future wife or girlfriend, though.
Keep that in mind.
Yeah, yeah. It'll never work. Yeah. All right.
But no, I agree. Like, the you know, there was intelligent writing going on this show, which is something that Star Trek at its best features in abundance. And I think this this episode just is, again, a great example of what DS9 does best. I think I wanted to kind of talk about briefly was the role of the Klingons here. We're seeing the Klingons are withdrawing from the Khitomer agreement.
Yes.
And what do you think of this idea of essentially backtracking the Klingons to potentially being adversaries?
They want to go back to the old ways. Well, I know for a fact, just based on interviews, I mean, this is the studio's idea. They right. want to make Klingons scary again and attract some of those old school watchers. I like it. I like to think that the Federation is going to be constantly progressive.
Right.
I like the idea that progress, I'm paraphrasing Barack Obama here, but progress is not always a straight line. So we've seen, you know, this long era of peace between the Federation and the Klingons. About like 70 years or so since the Khitomer Accords were signed. And the Klingons are like, we can only do so much at this point. I like this idea of them regressing to more of that warrior state and making them more dangerous. But Cam, you don't necessarily find the Klingons to be all that compelling of an antagonist, do you?
I like them a lot on the original series.
Sure.
I think they actually work really well in a lot of Deep Space Nine episodes. I think my issue is more that I found a lot of the Klingon stuff in TNG kind of got bogged down. Like when we were watching like Redemption, that was not one of my favorite two-parters to talk about. But in terms of like stories like this, I actually find them really engrossing.
Okay, well, what do you make of them going back to their old ways for at least season four?
It's something I kind of blanched about initially, where I was like, oh, I don't know that I like taking things back. Sometimes I think that's a poor move.
Yeah.
But it does make sense with a warrior race that they would get tired of being essentially subdued. So I like the idea that they would get fed up and want to conquer again. And heck, you know, they want to take on Cardassians, it's hard to argue for the Cardassians, which is a bit of the genius of this episode, because you swap it and make it the Bajoran yeah. people. Instantly, we're on the side of the Bajorans, right? With the Cardassians, we're like, well.
But I do like that Kira brings up the dissident movement and how it was Gamor who was involved with that, I believe. And that's why people are trying to kind of frame Gamor by using Kira as essentially the body double for his daughter in Second Skin. So it's interesting how you're tying in all the kind of mythology about the Cardassians as well. I wish they explored a little bit more of life on Cardassia under civilian, not military rule. I think that was a bit of a lost opportunity because, I mean, Dukat swings in with Dominion forces in just a matter of a year and a half, I think. So
Yeah.
Alrighty, Brady, I'm curious. Any final thoughts that you want to share, or what did you think overall? I mean, is this episode successful as kind of a full length outing for the Star Trek universe here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I honestly, like I said, I mean, there was a lot of action, and that's not always my biggest driver, but there's a lot of like just interpersonal dialogues going on. I thought it was a great intro episode. As being introduced into the series, I felt like, oh, this is a show that I continue watching more episodes. I have enough sense of these characters. There was no one I was like, why are they there? Like, you know, so.
Well, Jake Sisko wasn't in this one, so I don't know, man.
No, so it was a good, well-written episode.
Okay. Whoa. This is his first episode of Deep Space Nine. He's already throwing sass at Sirach Lofton, Cam. We've taught him well.
But, yeah, and I found, like, just I was excited when I realized it was going to be Klingon-centric. You guys told me nothing going into it. I'm always interested in those warlike cultures because I find their dynamics so fascinating when it's like
Mongolians.
Yeah, no, exactly. Because what do they do in diplomacy? How do they do that when their culture is built on expansion and all that kind of stuff? It was really, really good. I really enjoyed it.
No, I'm intrigued that, you know, kind of more of an outsider, a misfit such as yourself.
We're all misfits on this podcast.
No, but like somebody who's not super familiar with Deep Space Nine, and look, there's a lot of mythology that they built up for the first three seasons, but this wasn't overwhelming for you in that you felt as if, hey, maybe I could continue on with the series as well?
I'm a big Game of Thrones fan, and so it's just I enjoy this political intrigue. I enjoy when there's multiple people having multiple goals within an organization, and I was even getting that for the show. So it's enough that I'm interested enough in the series to try to figure out all these political parties.
Well, yeah, I never mentioned this to you until now, and I should have reminded you, but this is Ron Moore was one of the main writers on Deep Space Nine, mm-hmm. and I know for a fact you're a big fan of Battlestar Galactica, which developed. So you definitely, it's interesting when you go through Deep Space Nine, this is essentially like the closest sci-fi series you'll ever get to Battlestar Galactica when it comes to a lot of the themes that are going on and a lot of the devotion to character. Like, Cam, I think devotion to character in Deep Space Nine is definitely one of its hallmarks versus some of the other franchises or definitely. Some of the other series, right?
Yeah, for sure. Sorry, more Cam, so than any other Star Trek series by far.
I would definitely say so. But Cam, any thoughts about Way of the Warrior as a whole?
I love that this is an epic story. It's not just like a 2-hour episode like Birthright, which you referenced at the top of this episode.
James Cromwell.
Or some of the other TNG two-parters where we kind of go, well, you know, it was fine. Or even you could say The Die is Cast and Improbable Cause, which I really enjoyed a lot.
But it seemed like more of a smaller episode.
Yeah, right? It was like two episodes kind of that were blended together well, but it didn't feel like they were huge. This is a huge kickstart to a season. Tons of major events and an action sequence at the end, both the ship battles and the fight on Deep Space Nine, that I wasn't laughing or rolling my eyes at, which is rare with Star Trek battle scenes.
It wasn't like that fight over pottery aboard the in Gambit Part 1,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, yes. And did you notice that people's phaser hits were firing on first shot?
Yes, that's a rarity in Star Trek as well. But some of the blocking for those phaser hits, it's very clear that the director yelled action right as they were getting fired on
running to the scene.
James Conway, you know, he maybe dropped the ball on a couple shots, but he did a good job overall.
I feel bad I didn't bring him up earlier, but this was do you think this is more like a punchier episode directing wise more so than usual when we talk about
Star Trek? I think it was in a lot of ways, both in the way he's shooting his dialogue sequences, which have this real intensity that we don't even see on some of the other great episodes of Deep Space Nine, and then you mix that together with some of the best battle scenes shot for Star Trek period, it's a pretty it's a pretty major home run for Deep Space Nine and Trek in general.
I'll just highlight one shot, which is very, very odd for Star Trek. But you know when Drex goes and punches Garak's lights out, and you have that point of view shot of Garak looking at Drex? But that was really used very, very significantly during all the marketing for this episode of, the Klingons are back, and then you've got Drex punching out Garak right there. That's not a shot that we typically see in Star Trek.
It felt far more cinematic than even some of the TNG two-parters that kind of build themselves on being cinematic.
Yeah. So, Cam, maybe once we get through all these two-parters of Deep Space Nine in like 2 years or something, we'll give a definitive ranking of where this is. But I think so far, I would put this at the top of the list for DS9 two-parters, amongst those that we've reviewed for the podcast at this point.
I'd agree. And I mean, Cinefantastique magazine actually ranked this episode as the second best DS9 episode of all time, which I thought was interesting.
Okay.
Because when I read that, it was before I'd rewatched it, so I was like, really? Because, I'm thinking of The Visitor and Trials and Tribulations.
And Prophet and Lace.
Yeah, in the Pale Moonlight. Like, a lot of... Prophet and Lace. I'm thinking of a lot of the great DS9 episodes, that kind of took me off guard. But rewatching it, I can kind of... I don't know that I would rank it as the second, but I understand what might compel someone to say that.
I would, like, look at that list and go, huh? Really? Number two? But then after watching this episode just now, I'm just like, okay, I get it.
It's not embarrassing.
No, not at all. So
I'd rank it my highest two-part episode.
I appreciate that, Brett. Honesty there. Okay. Yeah, look, for me, I think a great episode, great way to kind of reset the series. I'm so happy that we've got Worf, because I don't think Worf is ever better than when he's on Deep Space Nine, and this is the start of it. So... works for me. When you picture Worf in your head, though, Cam.
Which I do often.
Gold uniform or red uniform?
the massage program outfit.
Okay.
No. Very specific memory.
I got to be honest, the gold uniform.
Yeah.
Even though I far prefer him on the on Deep Space Nine to TNG, yeah. The gold uniform is what jumps to mind.
And what haircut? The ponytail or the bob?
Actually, you know, it might be the DS9 haircut more.
Yeah, I think
it's so. It's a blend of the two. Best of both worlds, if you will.
I will. Maybe it also helps that you literally have a cardboard Worf cutout in your apartment.
That's true.
Yes.
In the gold uniform, yeah.
Okay, well.
Okay, so
not
I think...
Not in the massage uniform.
He had to make it himself.
That one's on back order. Okay, so on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. You can also reach us on Facebook. Tyler, what's our Facebook address?
Yeah, just either go to Facebook toolbar or search bar and just type in Subspace Transmissions, or also the easiest thing to do is go facebook.com/subspacepod. That's facebook.com/subspacepod. I would say it's worth it. Cam, we're posting exclusive content there, videos, commentaries for episodes that we're not posting in our iTunes or on Stitcher. It's really worth it. All you have to do is follow us. And guys, I'll say this. It's a free podcast. All we're asking is you just give us a follow. We actually had a lot of people do that over the past week. And I want to thank all of you guys that reached out and followed us on Facebook. And hopefully people out there can be the next ones that I thank live on air.
Well, we can only hope.
Yeah.
Okay, now what are we doing next week?
Cam, we will be examining the history and the evolution of uniforms on Star Trek. What's so funny?
No, I'm excited for this.
I am as well. I actually pitched this to you about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
You dismissed it, and then you came running back about 2 weeks ago and said, Tyler, I've got a great idea for an episode. And I was like, oh, tell me, Cam. And it's like, as long as you think it's your idea, then I'm glad that we get to do it, though. That's all I can say.
That's right.
But it'll be fun, and I think, Cam, we'll be posting images on the blog as well, so people, you'll be able to follow along with what we're talking about. So we want more of that audiovisual component, so you can... You know, you can picture the uniforms in your head, of course, but I think this will be a little bit more engaging for listeners, too.
Yeah, and we're going to be focusing more on the iconic uniforms, not so much on, hey, you remember that episode that random Bajoran wore in, you know, episode one's, you know.
Or like, what do you think of the Bajoran infirmary outfits?
Yeah.
It's kind of like,
there'll be none of that.
No, yeah. It's going to be the iconic stuff. And what makes it iconic, what makes it fun to, you know... cosplay in,
right?
Essentially, right?
Right.
Okay.
Exactly. Okay, so you can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in very into massage programs, Smith.
I thought you were going to go with vile root beer.
No.
But I like that you're very much into the massage program. Well, you can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N. N is in nice hat. Brett, can we find you anywhere on social media?
You can't. I'm a mystery.
Oh, wow. Like Garrick.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.